Welcome to the first installment of the Fine Arts Work Center's Winter Reading Series. My name is Matt Nall. I'm the writing coordinator. You all know that, but when I don't say that, Bob comes to me on Monday and says, "You didn't say who you were and no one knows," and it's unprofessional. So anyway, that was for Bob. We'll be having readings by writing fellows and visiting writers on Saturday nights from now until April. So I want to remind you about next week's reading on December 13th. The fabulous poet Dean Young is flying here from Austin, Texas, with his successfully transplanted heart in tow. That's not a metaphor. So visiting writers are nice, but what we look forward to most are the readings by our writing fellows. We get to hear them read for free before they're famous. We'll be hearing them read for free when they're famous. But then we can brag we knew them way back then. So tonight's first reader is first-year poetry fellow Alan Hamza. Good. Alan was born in Bosnia-Herzegovina and immigrated to the United States when he was 15. He received a BA from Wesleyan University and an MFA from the Michener Center for Writers at the University of Texas, Austin. His work has appeared or is forthcoming in Better Culture and Lit, Crazy Horse, Fence, Forklift Ohio, Narrative, and elsewhere. So please join me in welcoming Alan.
Thanks, Matt. I also want to thank everybody for coming and to extend an extra special thank you to all the Fox staff who make this possible. I feel very, very lucky to be here, and I want to express my gratitude for being able to spend 7 months in this wonderful, amazing place with such amazing souls, writers, and artists. So thanks. I'm going to start off by reading a poem by, not me, but by somebody else. But I will wait for the latecomers to get settled in first. The poem I'm going to read by someone else starts with, "Somewhere I have never traveled, gladly beyond." It's by E.E. Cummings. "Somewhere I have never traveled, gladly beyond any experience. Your eyes have their silence. In your most frail gesture are things which enclose me, or which I cannot touch because they are too near. Your slightest look easily will unclose me, though I have closed myself as fingers. You open always petal by petal, myself, as spring opens, touching skillfully, mysteriously, her first rose. Or, if your wish be to close me, I and my life will shut very beautifully, suddenly, as when the heart of this flower imagines the snow carefully everywhere descending. Nothing which we are to perceive in this world equals the power of your intense fragility, whose texture compels me with the color of its countries, rendering death and forever with each breathing. I do not know what it is about you that closes and opens. Only something in me understands the voice of your eyes is deeper than all roses. Nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands." So that's Mr. Cummings. And there's a funny story behind this poem. I think this was the poem that kind of got me started with poetry when I was in Bosnia and watching 90210. It's the poem that Brandon reads to Kelly when he proposes to her. And so I made sure to look up who this was, what this was, when I came over to the United States. And then I fell in love with E. Cummings and started getting interested in the written word. After that, in poetry, in its magic. So there's that. Okay, now we will continue with, the problem with reading somebody else's poems, obviously, who is really great, is that then you judge everything by what came before and then find it a little bit lacking. So only brave souls can do it, I tell myself. Okay, this is the beginning of my reading. The battle on the river Neretva. Appended desire knocks on my door. "Why were you asleep during the battle?" she asks. "I wasn't asleep," I want to say. "I was unborn, but desire, battered, has collapsed." I bring her in, take her coat off, lay her on the couch. I taste with my tongue the bruises on her arms. She's wearing pink jeans. They give off a sour smell, as if she had waded through milk. I stick a thermometer under her armpit. Withdrawn, the tip is cool and smells like soles. Button by button, I undo her shirt. The hairs on her stomach are borrowed from old men's ears. I still get hard. I plunge my tongue into her belly button. My tongue disappears. It is coated white and reeks like her jeans when I pull it out. Then I notice her breasts are leaking. I place my hands over them. She wakes up. She throws up over my hands and her torso. I expect red pentagrams. I get yellow speckled with green. "I'm sorry," she says. She looks at my penis, then grabs it and laughs. This one is called Dear Universe. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Dear Universe, many times you have said, "Buy a small boat, load it with desires, bring extra fuel, install a sunshade, and glide off into the Adriatic." I do as instructed, yet I end up paddling back to shore. Today the sea is naughty. Southerly wind is raging, branches are cracking, waves white-tipped are rolling. Extracting wisdom is busy work, and busy work is pimples. I would like to weigh my brain on the scale of decay. I would like to be blood equipped with a high-resolution camera. Is getting old as fascinating from the inside? I yawn at noon. I ban sprinklers from the grass. This is the first summer of my life that is spring. No one is swimming. A search for Scandinavian bodies yields an elegant, muscled zero. Fall starts are what life is. This morning, my being said to me, "Pluck the gray hairs." Goodbye, Biosil, favorite silica supplement. Goodbye, vitamin preparations for hair and skin and nails. I will shore the 30 gray chin hairs against the elements, and together we will brave the springtime sea, the whistling wind, the percolating stairs of the locals. This is kind of an old poem that made it and then didn't make it into my manuscript. Some people who are funny think it should be in there, and people who are more serious demanded that it be taken out. A mistake is sex. A Bosnian attempts a sonnet. I make a mistake at a party. The talk is of shoes, high-heeled sort. "Mine? They're uncut," a girl says. "Uncut?" I say, "like the penis?" Gasp? No gasp. Laughter, alas, plenty and rich. Though strangers to me, friends of the host, leave the kitchen promptly. I quote the Odyssey, which I'm wont to do in a crisis. A stranger comes back to replenish the drink I muse, but she says, "Was that from the Odyssey? How beautiful." "Why, yes," I say, assuming the scholar's pose. I don't have a scholar's nose. I repeat the quote. She repeats it too. We leave the party then and there, just us two. Summertime. An old man tames a squirming pipe. Two shirtless men are playing chess. 5 are handling the cards with their tongue-licked fingers. Seagulls come in many colors, white, black. Like sporadic protocols of lazy nations, they patrol the skies and determine the quota of the day's catch. 2 women are drinking midday beer and complaining about the lack of vanilla ice cream cones at the corner store. The smell of fried fish and olive drizzle chard tickles the noses of soccer-enchanted kids. A woman puts a crate of freshly picked figs on a sun-inflamed bench to dry. Her husband is going trash bin to trash bin in search of plastic and cans. The grown son trims his toenails under a tamarind tree. The overweight man, fond of his bicycle, buys groceries, tells the lady at the checkout, "Who can understand women? I got married late." Firefighting aircraft are taking off for Turkey. The locals are proud. It is Saturday, the wedding day. The guests go to the grooms, then the brides, then the church, then the reception hall. The minimum gift is 100 euros. Tourists are stalking the promenade, taking pictures of a blue 1984 Renault 4. The pizzeria on the south side of town has new oil-resistant tablecloths. It employs 2 waiters and 1 waitress. The post office is closed. Twice there was a country. I am afraid of my voice. I record it in the morning to scare myself at night. In it lives a red pentagram. In it lives a dead country. Inevitable historical processes perform through separate, if similar, parts. Come together. Clack, clack, clack. 6 times clack equals 2 eyes black. Twice dead means resurrection is a visible thread. I am nevertheless an atheist blessed. Balkan miracles have inverted consequences. Perverted are the hands of decay. Twice there was a country, and twice it faded away. Ashbury in Bosnia. My town is 5,000 souls long. I have told lies in the past, given it 15, 20 at times. Never on purpose, distance enlarges. There I took Ashbury, who was tired of the American poetry scene, and forests whose lungs are giving out, coughing chicken nuggets with a side of tar. We walked up the mountain of Preň. He took out his monocle and praised the E, the lone vowel in a forest of Balkan wolves. To help with pronunciation, I said, Preň is similar to Steň, which the heavenly grammar god admits as a word meaning wick, but which I, an earthly sufferer of no love, meant as a shortcut to Steňati, to moan. He showed me his varicose veins. He fingered my future, tracing rivers of the body's making. May I, sir, take a swim in you? How strange to say most important words with orbs. Silence pelted us. It descended like hail after you decide comprehensive coverage is for the rich. The clouds were pretty, maybe a little slim, cynical and dark, partly absurd, never sublime. Bosnian clouds shining on trousers in clouds, making their way amidst walnuts and pines, toilet paper sleeping on the side of the path, moss breeding to breathe the dark side. Reminds me of the Alps, a Swiss village, he said, surveying the valley below. The earth falls to rise and in the falling climbs to new heights, a higher constellation of puzzled interaction in which wins neither war nor peace. My soul wants to live here, I said, but I have never been good to my soul. We were now at the peak, and I apologized for my country not speaking French. It's okay, Ashbery said. Nobody's perfect. Poetry flows out of your country's mouth. It is beautiful, and it is enough. This one is called Where Love Naps, There Nip I. There is only one dust in this world. All the hats, pens, and watches are made from it. The wrens sing of it, sing in it. In it, my ex-lover bathes. I am naked today, and I was naked last night. I ate a burnt-out cigarette and did not clean my tongue. Most loving is fire, finite light. Feelings branch out. Feelings sing. Be you blithe and bonny. Day starts with dawn, pink or not. The following poem has four short parts, each titled separately. Exile, a sweet. Number one, childhood like pepper. The apple orchard lives in childhood. I live alone. 3 years, no pleasure but pleasure. Green days, blue days, pleasure over pleasure, a finite onion. Number two, the world with evil crackles. Purr of plum, give me. Give stark medallions slated for extinction. Father, extinction is for pussified hearts. The weaving must go on if we are to wear clothes. Thusly we thicken. Number three, Bosnia and Herzegovina. The right solitude lives in Bosnia. The wrong solitude lives in Herzegovina. No, it's the other way around. Wait, my country is falling apart again. Four, whether you love or lever power. Nothing we own is on Mars. Nothing at a desperate distance. Curl around holes. Do not be whole. A good-sized hole improves many things. Unlike chamomile, roses are flowers to be looked at. When as in silks, my love goes. When as the finite pleasure barks at forever. Crumble, disappear, exit empire. Again, the fable dies. A man of my gender once said to me, "Let it go, and it will go away from you." If in the end I realize I really wanted to be a poem, so what? Mary is lonely, said Tomáš about Mary. Whiff a freesia in architecture library. I architect into a teenager, all of 17. St. Louis summer, hello. And Bonnie, you took my breath away with your damp blonde hair before I knew how to handle cliches. All our future days in that moment were contained. Turtles in a pond, singing frogs, the cat you worried about because your grandmother insisted on mixing her hair in cat's meals. The same grandmother who haunted my dreams when I visited your Wisconsin palace. Two bottles at the 34th Street Cafe, Tomáš, and I walked out the back door looking for the bathroom. My love is a sprinter, a current piercing stone, branches, moss. You want a lick, says love to salmon, and a lick is born. You, Tomáš, both have and are a love like that. I was 12 and you 50 when we stopped sharing the soil of a fable called Yugoslavia. Mary thinks more about you than about me. When we met, she talked about squirrels while smoking. When she put the cigarette out, she talked about Mandelstam. Mary, I too am lonely. I love colors and the salty part of the wrist. Primer ruffled by the wind. The moon in me is the summer. Salty waves reach up to feed pedestrians scented with beach. More and more, the outer world is enough. A world long with exit, chug. Appealing, lizard-teeming terrace. Palm berries divorced from palm trees, chatting up flipped-flopped feet. A part of me belongs to wedlock. But what does my ghost? Apron heart. Peeling potatoes doesn't fulfill all Slavic needs. My place is small, and I have to travel to the city where you live. I am interested in staying at your place over the period of the convention, taking place at the convention center in the middle of the month of March. The last few years, it has been booked to the nose, full of, like a rotting log, maggots yapping. Connoisseurs, bearded but soft, appear waterlogged. I am not one of them. I am a man who has escaped cedar allergies, yet all I can think about is the ex-boyfriend of my girlfriend. I break down my thoughts into necessary and un, then end up smooching the un with wine-cracked lips. The lips are cracked to begin with, the wine seeps in, but it doesn't matter. How long a man can live off of doesn't matter. This, in all my travels, has changed none. I have a picture in my mind. On the floor of a Texas shanty bar, he's dancing with her. Their eyes are moon jellies. Why must I object to another issued happiness? I will, when I visit you, put on my Bosnian apron. It will keep the food out and the heart in. I think we're more than halfway through. So, don't worry. Oh, yeah, much better than halfway through. Great. This is called Shy Sailors. Pleasures of sea afternoons arrive to the neighbors skilleting fish and to the tomato lady. I have been praying outside God houses. I have proposed to Maria. Maria's feet are the heaven her sandals have prayed for. Fetishes are not words, yet compliments are fetish makers. Doctor, am I healthy? Summer consists of watching waiters wear striped shirts. Shy sailors are with us. The dead are with us, hungry hearts. The waves spray iodine and meaning, bring smiles to the faces of gout patients. Musculature of desire, let me in. Breathwork. Between my transformation and yours lives oxidized breathwork. I am waiting to be awaiting, a patient globe of grapes at falls expiring. Occult spices cannot save the onion. The union. At a younger age, I would have apologized and bracketed the mistake. On Tuesday nights at the Baptist Church basement, thin Chinese women gather to play mahjong. They are polite and fierce at once. I wish I were the silk woven into their blouses. All these years and the desire for community still paces my halls, like the desire to change. Du musst dein Leben ändern is one thing we never stop telling ourselves. If I were a bright blue ball, what kind of ball would I be? Letter to a Vacuum. Four limbs puncture the earth. Turn me on my back. Turn me innocuous. Show me celestial barricades. Tell me I can walk only in circles. Tell me you are a biting to which I must return. Turn me into cyan. No, turn me into a word. Utter me black. Say black and point to me. Then think, he is a word. Play me. Touch. Assume my hands. Glue my tongue on top of yours and say, my words are your dusk. Be rough. Make me knit you hats. Plant bugs in my fingers. Watch me ride. Vacuum cities. Manifest me. Molest me. Mother me. Atrociously father me. Two more. That's not the title. The Underground. Those under us are not dead. They are dancers. We are the music. Before I knew, I wanted to go down in ashes, down the river Neretva. Now I want to be buried. It doesn't matter where. Five major highways span the underground. They are, they say, superbly connected. And the last one. Thanks again for listening and for being here. This is called Double Negative. After 16 years, my parents are returning home. On more than one occasion, my father has said, there, I do not want to go. Here, I do not want to stay. The Bosnian language permits a double negative. English frowns upon it. I have not told my father that his life is not possible in his adopted tongue. Father's outbursts, I tell mother, are caused by the impending change. My mother doesn't buy it. My mother doesn't buy much anymore. She used to buy all the groceries. Father was the chauffeur. My brother and I will soon be living together. I'm looking forward to it. I'm not looking forward to it. The greatest impediment to happiness, Bertrand Russell said, is imagining other people's lives as better than our own. Slowly, my father, my brother, and I are becoming imagined people to my mother. What kinds of lives will she grant us? On which ocean's shores will she plant us? Thank you so much.
I forgot to mention, actually, that there are these really wonderful broadsides over there. If you want to check them out, that for tonight's readers, Monica made Alan's, and yes, in April, made Cecily's with Vicky's help. And so they're really wonderful and impressive, and so they're available over there if you want to make a small donation. First-year fiction fellow Cecily Scott lives in Perth, Australia, and her work has appeared in Southerly, Westerly, Hecate, Indigo, Eidolon, and Dreaming Down Under, which won a World Fantasy Award. A winner of the 2014 Eleanor Dark Flagship Fellowship for Fiction, she has been the recipient of residencies at KSP Writers' Centre, the Fellowship of Australian Writers, and Varuna. She holds a PhD in anthropology from Murdoch University and is currently immersed in a novel. Please join me in welcoming Cecily.
Hi, everyone. Like Alan, I would very much like to thank everybody at Fork for making it possible for us to be here and for me to fly across the planet to be here. And I'd also like to thank all the people in Australia that made it possible for me to fly across the planet and be here. And I would also like to thank the print shop amazing printers, particularly April Freely and Monica Wheelock and Vicky and Laura Eve, who made those astounding broadsides, which I do hope you'll have a look at afterwards. Are just beautiful. So I'm going to read you from my novel in progress, manuscript, project, whatever you call an unfinished thing like this, the working title of which is Inundation. And quite a few of you, I think, were here when I read a little bit of it before, where I read it set partly on HMS Beagle in 1830 and 1832. And I read you some of the stuff about the people from Tierra del Fuego who were kidnapped on the previous voyage of the Beagle before Darwin was there. And their names were Fuegia Basket, Eleparu, Boat Memory, and Jemmy Button. And I read you a little bit in which Boat Memory got smallpox and died, having arrived in England. The bit I want to read from you today is about the second voyage. So they've been in England for some time. The narrator is a ghost or water self of the young woman Fuegia Basket. So it's Fuegia who's talking to us. Boat Memory is a ghost, and she hasn't seen him since she left the shores of England. Jemmy is her young compatriot from Tierra del Fuego. Eleparu is the other kidnapped person from Tierra del Fuego, and they're now telling her that she has to marry him. Fitzroy is the captain. I think that's all you need. Sorry about all that. And Mr. Philos is a fairly famous scientist. He has set two boys on to drag up the net, but my hands are the first to clutch its slippery mesh. I lean over the side and snatch it from its rope and turn my shoulders on them, lifting the folds up to the sun. Most of what he has caught is scum, infusoria, he calls it, but there are a handful of tiny crustaceans, some brown bits of weed, and one very small slipping fish. I shake the mesh, making sure all the heavy things slide to the bottom. Water drips onto my feet and the bosun's scrubbed deck, and the bosun scowls and raises his voice. Bring it to the cabin then, says Mr. Philos, retreating in there. He is spreading some old canvas on the map table. From the slightly furtive way he rolls the charts to the side, I guess that the captain will not appreciate dampness here, but Fitzroy is in the orlops overseeing a shifted load. Rhythmic thumps and the creak of the smaller windlass suggest he won't be back too soon. I have found a bucket and am holding the dripping net over it. The rich vegetable smell of the weed rises in the slightly stuffy air of the cabin. Well, what have we? What have we got? He says. Bring it here, the light's better. When he's focused on something like this, he loses all that lanky awkwardness. I push the rolled charts further from the centre before lifting the filled nets. I pull the two edges of the net apart and his hand shoots out to grab one of the crustaceans. What's this? I swear, a nondescript. Let's put the ones to keep here on the left. There are two more of the crustaceans, waving feelers and a fat blue shell like a snail. It has glassy bubbles around its lip like a snail will ooze out if you torment it with a stick. But the bubbles seem solider. Purples and rainbows rainbowing on their edges. I'm sorry, purples and blues rainbowing on their edges. What's this one? Janthina. Probably Janthina janthina. Lives all its life on the ocean's surface. See the blue? What a colour. I've only seen these in jars and they fade inevitably. Let's keep that one wet for a bit and I'll have a look with a glass. And then all these confervae. How can I set up a microscope on all this canvas, though? There's a fish, I say. It is flipping among the wet folds, spasming in tiny leaps. I could put it back in the bucket. No, let me look, he says, and puts his big blunt fingers into the scum. The fish clenches and bows itself, fighting the air, and when he has nearly grasped it, flicks again and rises right out of his hand to bounce onto the deck. Whoa, get it quick! He is shuffling half under the table, crowding me with his shoulders, pouncing and missing, thumping the deck. Soon the whole ship will be in here. Got it, he says, and emerges red-faced and cheerful. He tips it out of his hand onto the canvas. Pass me my glass. But I am watching Fitzroy, rigid in the doorway, El Eperu behind him. I step back a little from the table. Mr. Philos looks up from his prize and smiles at the captain. We have found a great haul, he says, a nondescript crustacean, I'm almost sure, and this lively creature. Fitzroy says nothing. His gaze just flicks to where I stand. Wet points, wet spots decorate one rolled-up chart, and I'm holding another in damp fingers. I drop my gaze to the table where the fish now lies still and curved. There appears to be a structure emerging from its back, some strange fin, I think, and then I see it is its backbone, pearly and delicate, arched right out through its scales like a back-turned thumb. Miss Basket, says Fitzroy, York tells me Mr. Matthews asks for you for your catechism. Run along. Yes, yes, give me that, says Philos, taking the chart in even wetter hands. And can you fetch my glass before you go? I'd just like to have a quick look at this. It's dead, I say. It broke itself on the deck. I can see El Eperu standing behind the captain in the doorway. I know that Matthews has not asked for me. Philos is looking at his crustacean and Fitzroy at his charts, but El Eperu is looking at me. It's dead, I say again, but no one is listening. I thump down the stairs of the main hatch and push myself back through the narrow corridor to my little cabin. I'm anxious to get there before El Eperu can follow. For the first time, the very first time on this voyage, it occurs to me I should have a lock on this door, not just a little latch. I sit down on my bunk and scrub my still wet, weedy hands on my skirts. A marine smell rises up from my fingers. I think of the blue of the Janthina, that deep ultramarine, while staring at the pale smears. I try not to think of the fish. Yok Kushlu. No one on the ship has as deep a voice as El Eperu. I say nothing. Yok Kushlu, open the door. The little latch rattles a bit. Yok Kushlu. I rise and step the single step to the door. What? Let me in. I'm busy, I say. I'm reading scripture. Don't be stupid. I want to talk to you. I would rather open the door than have him snap the lock. I'll come out. But when I open the door, he shoulders it wider and steps inside. He is barefoot again, and that silence makes my own English shoes scuffling on the deck as I try to push the door again, the loudest thing in the room. What do you want? You must stay away from that Englishman. He pushes the door behind him. The cabin loses most of its light with the door closed. What Englishman? I mock, contemptuous, afraid. Which of the many Englishmen on this vessel? Be quiet, you know who I mean. That pale-haired one with his stupid fish. There is no reason for you to go near him. Leave him alone. He doesn't want you drifting around. I'm helping him, I say, suddenly furious. He's learning about all the world. He knows nothing about the world, and neither do you. He can't even work the ship, and he's sick half the time. You were sick when we first came aboard. You sat on the deck and puked like a baby. Be silent. El Eperu's face is always so still, and his body so held into itself that I have forgotten he can be like this. I have a sudden image of his face in the lane in Walthamstow, that uneasy violence that Fitzroy and his sister interrupted. Would he interrupt it now, if he knew? You will do as I say. I know I should be quiet, conciliatory, but as with last time, I burst into anger, frantic defiance. I will do what I wish. I will go where I wish. He slaps my face. It is a white flash followed by red. It throws me back against the side of the bunk. It's the first time he has touched me since that laneway. He steps forward, and I think he will hit me again. I can see it in his shoulders, but he doesn't. Instead, he puts both hands to his head. His hair is coming loose from its sailor's queue. His eyes are closed. Don't speak to me like that, he says, behind his hands. He lowers his palms. You will stay below decks or sit with a minister. He's weakling enough. You don't understand what might happen. Safe in my cabin, as I am now, I spit out. I can taste blood on my lip. What if I tell the captain what you did? Eleperu looks at me with a mixture of triumph and perhaps shame. He will tell you the same thing. He will tell you to do as I say. You know that. I say nothing. I feel sick. Eleperu makes another move towards me too fast. He is still angry and I flinch again. You will do it, he says again, and then he walks as silently as before out of the room. In the corridor, I see Jemmy's face quickly shadowed. I can't tell what he's thinking. I take my cut face to Surgeon Bino. He doesn't exclaim over it in surprise. It is a small ship. Still, I wait for him to ask me. I wait all through the time it takes him to heat the water to clean away the blood. He dabs it with unguent, tight-lipped. He tells me to put cream on it twice a day. He says nothing more. I avoid Fitzroy. It isn't hard to do. I'm not sure if I fear more his anger if he sees my mouth or his silence. Mr. Philos sends to ask if I would like to help him with the net again, but I do not go. The next day, while I'm on the deck, the carpenter puts a bolt on the inside of my door. It is a stout iron lock, well screwed into the wood, far better than the little brass ones I've seen elsewhere. I do not see him do this. I just return to the new metal gleam and a little pile of wood shavings around the door frame. I push the iron bolt across. It would withstand a quiet forcing, but not a determined one. I wonder whom it is meant to reassure. Yok Kushlu. It is Eleperu. I'm walking forward along the weather side, holding tight to the rail. The wind is bright and swift today, and the bark is heeled against it, sloping sharply. He steps out from behind one of the upturned boats at this angle. For once, I am nearly as tall as he. Yok Kushlu, would you like this? He holds something out towards me. I don't want it, whatever it is. I don't look at him. Look, I traded it with one of the lardboard watch. It's from the Far East. A fan. He unfurls it. Red and white blossoms and black branches. It shakes and stiffens in the wind as if it might take flight. What a strange gift for Eleperu to offer me. I would have thought he'd give me a gathering basket or the shell beads of a good Kaweskar woman. Take it, Yok Kushlu. I step back. Take it, will you? No, I say. I keep walking forward. The back of my neck feels stiff. I have difficulty imagining what he will do with the fan. I think if he can't trade it back, he'll probably throw it overboard. But the next morning, it is dangling from the outside of my door on its little pink silk wristband, tassels moving with the ship's yaw. And that's the end of that section. And then I'm just going to jump a bit forward. For some weird reason, this is in a different tense. So this is a little bit later. The other thing is that the person who's talking here is a water self. She's a kind of half-person ghost. And she's talking to the modern scientist, Isabel. So in the rest of this, when she talks to Isabel, that's who she's telling this story to. It was a stupid thing, Isabel. All the times I had stood in the bows while the men shuffled awkwardly past me to the seat of ease on the other side of the bowsprit and contemplated throwing myself into the water out of anger or hopelessness or sheer defiance, and then in the end I simply slipped. And not from the bow, but over the stern of the ship. I was balanced on the salt slick railing and peering into the creaming wake. One of the men had said he'd seen a shadow there, perhaps a dolphin. It was a humid, heavy afternoon, and the deck stank of oozing tar, and it had been too long since I'd washed my chemise, and the possibility of a dolphin promised some sort of relief from Matthew's droning demi-sermons, from the sound of Mr. Philos throwing up yet again into a bucket. The beagle did her little skip that she sometimes makes in uncertain wind, a sort of twist like a horse trying to throw you off, and she threw me off. This is what I felt like. the shock of the railing slipping from my hand, a long, surprisingly long plummet into sudden churning white, under into dark and then up again to choking foam. Down again, something was sucking me down, pulling at my arms and legs, swirling me round, and then a numbing, thumping blow, and the world went red and blinding and silent. There is a gap here. When the world commenced again, I was swimming in green. Dark jade hills surrounded me, moving sickly. I could not see the ship. The swell that had seemed so insignificant from the deck, far too soft to justify Mr. Philos's determined puking, now hemmed me in with waves. The tropical waters were not warm at all. Bino had told me that if a man falls overboard, the ship moves so swiftly away from him that it may be lost over his horizon almost instantly. For this reason, he said, many sailors do not learn to swim, preferring a swift drop to the depths. But I learned to swim before I could walk, though the sodden skirt now hampered my legs. In the trough of a wave, I tipped my head back and wished for the sun. I wondered if anyone had seen me fall. Cold, salt, moving green. The waves held not a tinge of blue, just those malachite colours and purple shadows. And then the stooping sun did come out, and it all changed to emeralds and golds. It was well on into afternoon, and the larger waves held the light like stained glass windows. I breathed in the warm air and kicked off my skirt. It sank away shadowy, and as I watched it, I saw another shadow somewhere down there. Only then did I shout. The shadow moved below me again, then rose up with the swell and hung in a curling wave almost above me, like a fly in amber, like a wasp hovering, a shark. A ship following shark, that flickering shadow in the wake these last weeks, common enough. With that shadow in glassed above me, I found I could not call out. I could only hang in the moving sea as it hung, still and silent. It occurred to me that all my wishing for defiant death was purest petulance. I did not wish to die at all, not then. With that, I could shout again and bang on the water surface. The shadow sank and then rose with the next swell. It was closer still, and then I saw its dappled belly, brown and spotted like a fawn, and heard its gasp on the other side of the wave and knew it for a dolphin. If I spoke to the dolphin in that moment, Isabel, I will not tell you what I said to her. I lay back in the waters again. I knew I was safe there now. I was thinking of Jonah thrown overboard and Noah and his flood and the flood of my mother's people sent by Ibis woman. The survivors were cast upon mountains. These seas were mountains, hills. I will lift up mine eyes to the hills. I felt calm and sleepy, and the sunlight still warmed my face, though the cold pressed upon my breastbone. My legs were going numb. When I slipped below the gold-lit surface, it seemed only to rest better, to let myself drift down into welcoming jade depths, like the cool curtains in the house in Rio moving softly through an afternoon siesta, slipping into glass like the little plants under the microscope, the confervi simple and self-sufficient and dreaming in warm waters, downwards through lit depths. When I saw him swimming towards me, I felt such calm delight. The feeling rushed through me like laughter, all sweetness. He was pushing the water aside with those canoeist's arms, his Kaweskar chest wide and bare, his black hair streaming behind him, descending from the rippling ceiling of the sea. Boat memory, I said to him, and watched the bubble of those words swell from my lips and burst upwards. Then he was pulling me for the surface. His hand hurt my arm a little. Not so hard, I chided, faintly surprised. We can drift now. But he tugged me harder, and the world burst bright and cold and painful back into my lungs. I choked and spat and tried to sink again. My eyes burned. There was a darkening sky and moving waters and a huge shadow near us that I slowly saw was the Beagle's boat, men reaching and shouting over the side. I clung to Boat Memory's warm shoulders, pushed my nose into the back of his neck. He was alive. He was back. No ghost, but solid under my hands, black hair sticking to my face, Boat Memory. But he turned his head and he was Eleperu. I dropped my hands, pushing back away into the water. Hands grabbed my armpits and hauled me over the side of the boat, bumping and scraping. "The little maid's alive, Jose!" Eleperu came over the side, tipping us wildly. He was grinning and exhilarated, panting and wet. Someone had wrapped me in a blanket, and I stared at him from its folds. When he saw my face, his smile dropped away. The men were pounding his back, shouting, but he saw me. His face went still and he looked away, turned that bare shoulder and moved to take his seat in the bows. A seaman pushed a flask of brandy at my face. While the others went for the oars, I drank, bumping my teeth, my throat flaring. I closed my eyes. By the time we made it back to the ship, the whole ocean had turned blue at last, and I was puking up seawater in the belly of the boat. And I have one last section. It's less than 2 pages. And this is the bit that, a little bit from this, is on the broadside. So this is the bigger bit. So this is later. Fuegia has split into a land self and the water self. The water self has walked back across the Atlantic to England. And she's unable to walk on the land. She's unable to walk on the water. And she gives birth just off Devon. I bit the cord through. I imagine I am not the first to do so. I knotted it close to her arched newborn belly and I bit it through. That blood was the first food I had tasted since I split asunder. It was the last too. If I taste anything in my mouth to this day, Isabel, it is that our mingled blood. I stripped the blood back to her and I knotted it and bit it through. Held her to my breast on that shallow Plymouth Bay, squatting still on the grey water. I watched her blush slowly, flush limb by limb and grow heavy. Her hair was black and sparse and always, already, promised a wave in it, not the thick straight hair of my people. Her eyes were thunder grey, storm blue, her red mouth pursed and sorrowful. She had eyebrows fine as ink strokes, my daughter. She was Kaweska, Yamana, British. She was nothing, the sea's child, the bruised moon's daughter. I put my bloodied lips to her small fist and kissed her fiercely. Already she was growing heavy. She turned her head on my breast and I felt her start to sink down towards the sea. She was becoming flesh. Becoming the world, becoming, oh joy and horror, real. If I held her further, she would slip right through my hands and drown. I cannot speak of this well. Suffice it to say, I carried her to the shore. I pushed her, my naked daughter, onto the sea-wracked sand where I could not follow. Let it be said that like a savage, I abandoned a naked child on the grey-brown sands of Plymouth Town. It was an English day. The sky grey, white, and the water still and dull grey too, and flat as a puddle all the way out to a pewter horizon. Not a cold day, as the English judge them, just dull, with rain before and the promise of more. All the world's steel colours, except for the baby on the beach, flushed with birth and bright with her mother's blood. I am a wraith, Isabel. What they left of me, I gave to her, the bright remnants of a land self. All my people gave me, all they gave me that was of earth, the food that nourished me, the bones that grew from my land, the blood my father's hunting fed, the hope my kind aunt planted. Even the bones I grew in England, lamb and ship's biscuit and infant school porridge, even those I gave to her. All I have left is stories, and I would have given her them too. I would have given her them too. So let me tell you a story now. The wraith stands at the water's edge, not on the land but on the water's side. A ghost on a grey bright surface, scarcely rippling. The wraith stares at the sand where a naked child lies in the mild air that is still too cold, Isabel, that will sap the infant's heat like so many leeches. The child kicks and purses her English mouth. Soon she will wail, who did not protest her birth. Already the wraith is wailing. and then a man comes, walking down the stony hill. He is a dark man in a dark coat. He's walking towards the child. He picks his way past the clumps of purple weed, the storm-tossed shells. He walks up to the child and stops. His head comes up and he looks hard down one end of the beach and then the other. For a moment he seems to stare right into the face of the water self, but then he is stooping again. He shouts. He has dark hair and a straggling beard and a wide dark muffler. He unwinds this muffler and gathers up the child, brushing sand from her and salt. Others are coming across the stone-strewn levels now. A woman and another, a tallish youth and two shock-haired children, bright clothes and dark coats too large for them. One woman's skirt is bright red and pinks. The youngest child is barefoot on the sand. They gather round the man and the infant, murmuring, and again they peer up and down the strand. The wraith stands still on the water. She will not call again. She holds her insubstantial hands to her insubstantial, milkless breasts. And so they go, the man carrying the muffled child, the woman bending close. The youth stops to hurl a stone in the water, but not quite at the ghost, not quite. The bright-skirted woman calls him sharply, and she too seems to hesitate to look into the pale water, but she turns away again, and on they walk, clustered now around the new discovery, fading into the stony hillocks and the mist. Let me tell you that story, Isabel. Let it be so. Oh, Isabel, let it be so. And that's all. Thank you.